From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll learn about an uptick in ATV and UTV deaths in Wisconsin and ways to prevent them. Then we'll explore the Milwaukee Public Library's Great Lakes Marine Collection, which, among many other things, documents Great Lakes shipwrecks.
Being able to see 3D models of them really helped me better understand the tragedies I was writing about and helped me figure out how to explain them to other people.
Plus, we'll help you plan a trip to Horicon Marsh in Wandering Wisconsin.
We always tell people, you may have seen a very small portion of Horicon Marsh when you visited, but we can guarantee that every single time you come, you will see something different. You will experience something different.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. At least 30 people have died in ATV and UTV crashes so far this year, putting Wisconsin on track to surpass the 32 deaths reported last year. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources has noted most victims weren't wearing a helmet at the time of the crash, and more than half weren't wearing a seatbelt. The number of injuries and deaths have been trending upward in recent years since the onset of COVID-19. Jake Holzclaw is the Off-Highway Vehicle Administrator for the state's DNR. He joins Lake Effect's expert Nunez to share ways these crashes can be prevented.
Over the past decade, riding ATVs and UTVs has become a popular activity in Wisconsin, and a record high of nearly 500,000 ATVs and UTVs were registered in the state just last year. Have you noticed the registered number of four-wheelers continue to grow this year?
Yes, our numbers of ATVs and UTVs, so utility terrain vehicles, some people call them side-by-sides, has been continually growing over the last few years. It's approaching 500,000 registered machines. It's become a very popular sport statewide. And we have a number of trails, but we also have a number of road routes throughout the state. And I think just about every county now in the state has roads that are open for legal operation of these machines.
And where do these increases in registrations stem from? Are more towns allowing residents to ride these vehicles?
Yeah, I think it's a couple reasons. I think first and foremost, riding on an ATV or a UTV is just great fun. It's become a really popular sport. We saw quite a bump actually around 2020, 2021, kind of during the COVID years, where folks were just trying to find different ways of getting outdoors and do things outside. And like you said as well, there's been an increased number of road routes that are open to the machines. And so I think it really has made the sport more accessible for folks. No longer are they restricted to riding on, you know, the home farm or their own private land. There are legal road routes open now where they can get their machines registered and get out there and ride on those roadways.
Right. And so far this year, there have been 30 fatal ATV and UTV accidents in Wisconsin, and unfortunately, we're on track to surpass last year's 32 fatal accidents. What are some of the common contributing factors you've noticed in these crashes?
Yeah, so we always want to stress the safety issues. And in the majority of these crashes, folks are not wearing helmets. Helmets are just, they truly do save lives. Wisconsin does have a rule that anybody under 18 has to wear a helmet while on one of these machines as a passenger or as an operator. But what we really want to stress is that, you know, once you turn 19 or 20 and surpass that 18-year-old range, your head doesn't necessarily become stronger. You know, it's still a really needed piece of safety equipment. And the numbers show it. I think there was only two or three of those crashes where somebody was wearing a helmet and they were still killed in the crash or seriously injured. So the majority of them are not wearing helmets. And then in the case of UTVs, every UTV has a set of seatbelts in it. And not only is it state law that every passenger wears a seatbelt, but it also is just really good safety practice because just like a car or truck, those safety belts keep people inside that machine. And so, you know, a combination of helmets and seatbelts in a UTV make them quite safe to operate. The issue we see is that folks are not wearing the helmets, they're not wearing the seatbelts, and then they can be tossed free of that machine or pinned under one of those machines. And that's what's causing some pretty severe injuries or fatalities. And in a lot of cases, these folks are, you know, under the influence of alcohol or a drug or some other substance. And that, of course, is going to slow the reaction time and potentially cause them to make poor decisions when they're on those roadways or trails. And then another theme we're seeing is people driving too fast for the conditions or too fast for their experience. And we just want to make sure that people are driving safely, driving defensively, just like in a motor vehicle. We totally get it that ATVs and UTVs are a lot of fun. They're a recreational machine, but these machines do not handle like a normal motor vehicle handles. And then we see people maybe taking turns too fast or tipping those machines. And that's sad because all these crashes are easily preventable.
Absolutely. And can you just tell me about the trails or the roads where people tend to ride their vehicles illegally and how that should be avoided?
Yeah, I think before anybody gets on a machine, you know, whether you're a seasoned veteran riding one of these or new to the sport, be sure to check your local regulations. So, you can call the sheriff's department, a local police department before you get out on those roads. Each road that is open as an ATV or UTV route is supposed to be signed and marked. And then if that is a legal ATV route, it also has to be backed by a local ordinance of some kind. So the county or the town is aware and they're the ones that would have made that legal for the operation on that roadway. And the other thing I would encourage folks to do is take an ATV safety course. Anybody born after January 1st of 1988 legally needs to have a safety course anyway. So, you know, once you turn 16 or 21, it doesn't mean that you're automatically able to legally ride one of these machines on a public road or trail. But we would encourage anybody that has not taken the safety course to take it because it really does cover current laws. It covers the current safety rules that people want to follow.
And on the topic of the safety course, the victims in these fatal crashes this year range as young as 4 years old to 79 years old. Mm-hmm. Are there any other requirements to drive an ATV or UTV in the state?
I mean, yeah, number one is the age requirement for the safety class. So again, anybody born after January 1st of 1988 needs to take a course. But then additionally, yes, there are age restrictions. Very common ones are once a operator turns 16, they can legally operate on a road route or a trail without any kind of adult supervision. That is, of course, you know, if they have that safety class. From the ages of 12 to 15, they can operate on a trail as long as they have that safety course. And as long as, their parents are okay with it, they can actually run on a trail without adult supervision. Now, I should preface that with the ages 12 to 15, that is on an ATV. Now, with a UTV, a little bit different rule in that no matter if it's a trail or a road route, you have to be 16 to operate a full-size UTV. In general, we tell folks, you know, if you're interested in riding a machine, by the time you're 11 or 12, you know, take that course. Once you turn 12, you can start to operate those machines legally.
Right. And just to clarify, do you need a driver's license or special ID to drive these vehicles?
So the state of Wisconsin does not require a valid driver's license to operate one of these machines. However, there are some local counties or towns that may have a local ordinance that requires a valid driver's license. And so the DNR does not have, we don't have a say on that, but I would encourage folks, you know, if you're traveling, especially on a roadway, just make sure that they're following all the rules. Because if they do have an ordinance that requires a driver's license, then, you know, most of those drivers would have to wait until they're 16.
And how much does it cost to register an ATV or UTV? And do you need insurance coverage for them?
There's the registration fee. That's about $30. So the registration is good for 2 years. And the state of Wisconsin does not require these machines to have insurance. Of course, it's not a bad idea. I would definitely recommend that folks get insurance. And then again, there are some local towns and county ordinances that require insurance. So again, folks are going to want to check with local units of government just to make sure that they're operating legally.
Right. And back on the safety training course, Do you find that the people who are in a fatal crash, are they usually safety certified?
In past years, generally folks that were involved in fatalities had not taken a safety course. So I think that that does show that the safety course does help. And one of the trends we were seeing is that there was an older age group of folks that were getting hurt or killed, you know, folks in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. And of course, those folks are grandfathered in where they are not required to take the course. So there certainly could be a correlation there. And that's why we encourage everybody to take the course.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so we've talked a bit about requirements. How are these safety regulations being enforced?
A variety of ways. We like to take an educational approach first and foremost. We want to get the information out to the public throughout the year. We try to make sure that, you know, some of those busier weekends and busier holidays, there's an added saturation in both safety messaging and a added enforcement activity. The first weekend in August this year, and then also last weekend, we had a Think Smart Before You Start safety enhancement campaign. It's an all hands on deck effort where we call on local sheriff's departments and then conservation wardens around the state and anybody who's available to work to really have that presence on the trails and the roads and make those contacts with the public. You know, a lot of times those enforcement contacts are educational. And then sometimes if it's a serious enough offense, you know, like maybe a kid not wearing a helmet or somebody operating while intoxicated, then citations are issued for sure in some of those cases. But, you know, it's a real balance. It's a balance between education and then getting out there and that hands-on approach and enforcement in the field.
So last year, there was a bipartisan group of state lawmakers that introduced a bill to make it illegal to carry open containers of alcohol while driving ATVs and UTVs on public roadways. But it did fail to advance in the legislature. If a bill like this were to be introduced again, could something like this help this issue?
I think potentially it could, even though it is currently legal to have an open intoxicant on a machine. I want to remind folks that the same intoxication levels and laws apply on an ATV as they do in a motor vehicle. So same rules that you cannot operate while intoxicated and you cannot be over a blood alcohol limit of 0.08. Or operate with any kind of illegal substance or drug. So I think it could help for sure. I think it, you know, would have been a step in the right direction, but we'll just have to see where that goes in the future.
Of course. Well, Jake, thank you so much for speaking with me today and for helping me further understand this issue.
Absolutely. Not a problem.
Jake Holzclaw is the Off-Highway Vehicle Administrator for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. He spoke with Lake Effect's Excrete Nunez. Doors Open is back this weekend. Since 2001, Doors Open Milwaukee has celebrated Milwaukee's buildings and history. Over 150 businesses, organizations, and people open their doors and allow the public to get a behind-the-scenes tour. Grace Fuhr is the events director for Historic Milwaukee, and Venus Williams is the executive director of Alice's Garden Urban Farm and the Fondy Food Center. Fuhr organizes Doors Open, and Williams helped develop Historic Milwaukee's digital tour of the Lindsay Heights neighborhood. They both join Lake Effect Sam Woods. Fuhr starts with what people can expect from Doors Open this year.
Doors Open is an opportunity to tour Milwaukee's treasures, some lesser known gems and some known institutions, some places that you may not have access to otherwise and some that you regularly do, but maybe it's your first opportunity to visit. So this year we have 155 locations and people can tour all of these buildings and gardens and art galleries for free over the course of 2 days, September 28th and 29th.
You mentioned Doors Open has been going on for a while. What's new this year?
We have at least 30 new sites, and one that I'll mention that's downtown that's big is the new Baird Convention Center. So if you haven't been there, they have a really cool rooftop view of the city and a lot of local art that is throughout the space there. There's also a new one in the Third Ward called 217 North Broadway. It was formerly a coffee roaster, and it's now an artist collective. Another one that I'd love to mention is 414 Floral, and that's on King Drive. It's a really cool shop that you can go to anytime, but the shop owner will be there answering people's questions so you can get to know it and a little bit better. And then there's one in River West called 504 East Center Street, or the Brick House, and that's a new events house in River West.
So I remember one of my first Doors Open experiences was at those control towers downtown by the drawbridges. And I was so excited to go into one of those and just kind of see all the little buttons and everything. But Grace, do you remember your first Doors Open experience?
I do. It was the first Doors Open that happened in 2011. And I was working for Historic Milwaukee in a different capacity at the time. So I was part of, I started this job maybe like 2 weeks before the first Doors Open ever happened, and there was a lot of like, okay, how do we recruit 300 volunteers and how do we get this information out to the public? And then the most amazing thing was being at City Hall that day, which was the original event headquarters, and hundreds of people came streaming through the building. Milwaukee's former mayor Tom Barrett was there and was just in awe of all of these people who were very happy to be there and not paying their taxes, but enjoying the architecture and the history of the building. So that's my first memory.
Astute listeners may be able to hear the wind and kind of rustling leaves and some bugs, and they might recognize these sounds from earlier in this week when we were at Alice's Garden, and that is because we are back at Alice's Garden, which is one of the Doors Open locations this year. And so, Venus, can you talk a little bit about Alice's Garden and why you wanted to participate in Doors Open this year?
I love Doors Open. For me, Doors Open marks the beginning of the autumn season. I know that there's this other calendar official date, but the beginning of autumn for the city of Milwaukee begins with Doors Open. Every single year, there are people who come through here for the very first time, and there are always people who come every year, and each year they bring someone new back with them. That's just a win, 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 win. There are so many people who would never come to Alice's Garden, Urban Farm, and other sites if it were not for Doors Open. And then throughout the entire year, I could be grocery shopping, I could be down at the public market, I could be in some other incredible venue in this city, and someone will say, I met you at Doors Open. I saw you at Doors Open. You told that incredible history about Alice's Garden, Urban Farm, and the Lindsay Heights neighborhood.
Speaking of that history of Alice's Garden and Lindsay Heights, can you speak a little bit about Alice's Garden and who it's named after?
Alice's Garden is named after Alice Mee Taylor, who was the first African-American executive director of Milwaukee Cooperative Extension. Extension used to be the entity that managed the garden. It is now managed by our ministry, which is called The Table. And when Alice died suddenly in 2001, I believe the year was, the garden was named after her the very next day. The garden itself is in year 52. People will say over and over and over again that Venus started the garden. I did not start this garden, but I am blessed to be able to be one of its many caretakers and curators at this point in time.
So, Venus, when people visit the garden, what do they usually tell you about it?
The very first thing is its size. When people think of a garden, which is why we're always clear that this is an urban farm, even people who drive around it on a weekly basis, once they walk into the garden, they are amazed by how large it is. It is 2.2 acres. They are amazed by how peaceful it is out here. You can close your eyes and you may think you're in a wooded area, in some rural, beautiful setting, or at a national park, but you are in the heart of the city of Milwaukee on the north side. They're also totally taken back by the beauty of everything that is cultivated here, that is sprouting up from the earth, from the herbs, from the art, but also the beauty of the diversity of the people who farm and garden here. One of the other things that people are totally amazed about, especially if they come from the suburban areas and the rural areas, Doors Open isn't just for people who live in the city of Milwaukee. People come from all over the state for Doors Open Milwaukee. And this space and so many others defy the stereotype of what urban Milwaukee looks like, and especially what the African-American neighborhoods and communities in Milwaukee look like. So if you can't make it for whatever reason during Doors Open, Historic Milwaukee has created some wonderful guided tours, the apps. And so we just finished the Lindsay Heights app that you may download and utilize at any given moment on your life journey from this point out. I was very honored to be asked to help write that app and to be one of the narrators on that app, along with a gardener here at Alice's Garden, who also lives right here in Lindsay Heights, by the name of Eugene Bivens. And it is a wonderful way to walk the Lindsay Heights neighborhood and learn about the history and the people and the culture and the beauty and the hope and the expectations that we have for this community.
When you're developing this tour of Lindsay Heights, take me to the very first moments of choosing, like, okay, what kind of story do I want to tell? You know, who is my audience? What do I want people to get from this? Like, what are those initial thoughts, and how did that get to the tour on the app that we have today?
Well, Historic Milwaukee identified a whole list of sites here within Lindsay Heights, and then we narrowed it down, and then I got to play. I got to explore. I learned so much about many of the buildings and properties and sites here in Lindsay Heights that I did not know about. My first passion as a young girl was writing. I have journals. I'll be 63 years old this week, and I have journals from when I was 10 years old. So to be able to write this app and to make it come alive, again, to me it was just an honor and a blessing, and I hope that people really enjoy what they hear about this neighborhood.
You touched on something that I think gets at the spirit of Doors Open, at least for me, which is familiarity, specifically familiarity from something you were previously unfamiliar with. You mentioned, you might drive past Alice's Garden and wonder, what is that? And then Doors Open is that opportunity to find out what that is, right? But I want to ask you both, this can be related to Doors Open or not, can you think of something recently that you either tried or you were previously unfamiliar with that you tried for the first time and loved it?
I recently went surfing in Lake Michigan at Atwater Beach. A couple of weeks ago, there were some 4-foot waves, which people who surf on the ocean will laugh about, but that's pretty decent for Lake Michigan. And I've had a few experiences in Lake Michigan surfing, but this was my first time solo with a board that a friend gave to me. And yes, it was very invigorating. It was a really unique opportunity to spend time at a beautiful beach in Milwaukee.
Wonderful. And Venus, are you?
I cannot think of one thing, which tells me I need to work a little less and get out a little more. And I say that to say, every year I say we're going to do one day of Doors Open so that I can go experience something else. But then Doors Open happens and I have to do both days. So I am making the commitment on air that in 2025, I am going to experience 3 new things during Doors Open Milwaukee.
That is huge. That is huge. You heard it here first. Well, Grace, Venus, thank you so much for joining me on Lake Effect, and I'll see you out there at Doors Open.
We'll see you there.
Thank you for having us.
That was Grace Fuhr, Events Director for Historic Milwaukee, and Venus Williams, Executive Director of Alice's Garden Urban Farm and the Fondy Food Center. They both join Lake Effect's Sam Woods. WUWM will be participating in Doors Open this year on Saturday. To learn more about Doors Open and how you can come visit us and see the station, head on over to WUWM.com. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Just search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcast to download and listen to us on demand. In about 15 minutes, we'll tell you about one of the largest freshwater wetlands in the country that you can visit right here in Wisconsin. But first, we'll dive into the Great Lakes Marine Collection at Central Library for our Books and Beyond series. That's coming up on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. We'll be right back. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The library is more than just books, and our series with Milwaukee Public Library, Books and Beyond, showcases that by sharing resources, book recommendations, and just some cool stuff you might not know about. Today, we are going to take a deep dive into MPL's Great Lakes Marine Collection. It's made up of books, magazines, journals, directories, logbooks, and photos. There are also 12,000 ship files dating back all the way to 1650, making it a great collection for maritime enthusiasts to explore. I visited Central Library to meet with local author Anna Lardnoy, who's written about shipwrecks, and Special Collections Librarian Tobias Fudge to learn more. Fudge begins by explaining how this collection came to be housed at Central Library.
Herman Runge, he was a collector. He worked for the Milwaukee Road, and so that afforded him a lot of travel. But he was a hoarder. I mean, he collected so much extensively on the Great Lakes ships. And so at the time of his death, at 1958, he bequeathed his collection to us. I know some of the managers had been in talks with him trying to get this collection for some time. And then a year after that, that's when the Wisconsin Marine Historical Society was founded to help process it and also to get other collections and just preserve and protect all this information on the Great Lakes and the ships.
Now, Anna, you're the author of several books, including one about shipwrecks of the Great Lakes here. So what drew you to these stories, and how did this collection at the library play a part in either research or writing?
Well, this collection captured my attention since the moment I saw it. Just walking into the humanities room and seeing the models of ships that are legendary wrecks just helped me dive into their stories so much deeper. And when I walked into where the Wisconsin Marine Historical Society keeps their records, it felt like walking into a magical place. There is actually a piece of the Edmund Fitzgerald in that collection. And I got to see it. I could have touched it. Maybe. Tobias said no. But how magical is that?
Really magical. And it kind of helps break down some of the more intimidating big picture things, right? To be able to kind of scale in on an individual basis. So
I'm not a sailor. I am just captivated by shipwreck stories. So some of the boats that I was writing about, I was not entirely sure exactly what they looked like. And being able to see 3D models of them really helped me better understand the tragedies I was writing about and helped me figure out how to explain them to other people who also haven't seen boats that look like that.
Yeah, I think we sometimes take it for granted living right on Lake Michigan, and we don't have as much ship traffic as there once was. So being able to dive into these and kind of explore the different era of when boats were kings, queens of the lake, our personal ocean, as you'd call it, what did it show you about Milwaukee, you know, and our place in not only trade and merchant world, but kind of how it helped shape our city?
Well, I think that we wouldn't be here without the lake. And the lake makes it possible to bring people, especially over for the development of the Midwest. A lot of the stories that I tell, these tragic shipwrecks, were people who were immigrating from Europe through this path called Up the Lakes, that they may make it to Michigan or make it to Superior, and that is how we get so many Scandinavian and German settlers. They were coming down that path. So I think it shapes the whole area. Milwaukee probably wouldn't be the city it is without having the river coming right off the lake and allowing us to deliver all of these goods that we make and we bought to the city itself.
Yeah, speaking of the rivers, there's a whole subsection of this collection called Milwaukee Waterways. Tobias, could you share a little bit about that?
We have, I believe, 50,000 images. Of those, 1,000 of them have been digitized. You can actually go on our website and be able to see a very healthy chunk of the collection that's been processed, and all the metadata has been added so that they can be more easily searched and found. But yeah, the Menominee, the Kinnickinnick, and the Milwaukee rivers and the port, yeah, Milwaukee wouldn't exist were it not for where all these rivers come together, yeah.
And some of the images that are in that specific section of the collection, What do they show? What are some of the most common things you see?
Besides the harbors, the port, lighthouses, we have a very good collection of those. And then, yeah, ships, I feel like, is what patrons most often request.
Excellent. So you did a bunch of amazing work before we got here at the library and pulled a bunch of materials for us to look at. So let's take a look.
Here are some blueprints. This is the Prince Willem V. This isn't the ship that sunk. This is a motor ship that was built a year and a half later to replace it. But we actually have around 200 blueprints and a few maps of harbors, which are fairly unique. Not many people know that we have them. And then over here, we've got different maps of, they call them treasure maps or wreck charts, just all the different locations that ships have gone down and over the years.
And something like this really captures a writer of shipwrecks' imagination, where all these things are. And the thing I like most about it is this will be forever changing as we have better technology to discover new shipwrecks.
That is true. Let's take a look at some of the maps on this other side here.
Speaking that to the ever-changing nature of it, I mean, this is a periodical that came out 2021, and yeah, it has multiple articles from the Shipwreck Journal on new information on shipwrecks, shipwrecks that have been lost and people are still looking for, some that have been found, some that are being having more dives in them to find more salvageable equipment or just for pleasure.
Okay, so still with some great imagery and artistry. Mm-hmm. We're still on shipwrecks, but we have some unique artistic rosters of that. Can you explain?
You can definitely tell that these were made in the 70s. Throughout the collection, you can see it's the same information that's being looked at, but it's being kind of shaped different ways. This collection of these Captain Pete's Maritime maps, a lot of attention to like the actual images of the ships were added, and you can see you needed multiple pages to be able to fit all the different wrecks from the different lakes. I've seen them break down wreck information by which lake, just chronology, which decade it happened in, the type of way that the ships were sunk. So yeah, there's a lot of different ways of looking at the same information.
For sure. So Anna, with what you were looking at and the shipwrecks you picked to write about, do you want to share a particular wreck that caught your attention?
Well, I think that the most famous wreck when we're talking about Great Lakes shipwrecks is, of course, the Edmund Fitzgerald. And it has such a prominent Milwaukee connection because Northwestern Mutual owned the ship. Edmund Fitzgerald lived here in Milwaukee, the real man. And there are pieces of that ship all over this library. And, you know, that's magic. That is how I really got into loving ships, by hearing that song when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And then I just discovered this whole world of shipwrecks. And I'm mostly known for writing ghostly tales. And shipwrecks and ghostly tales really do go together quite well. Over 30,000 sailors have lost their lives on the Great Lakes. And those are modern numbers since we have been looking at ships. That number grows every year. And so there's just infinite room for those stories to be told.
And I feel like with the Fitzgerald in particular, and I'll speak personally, I didn't realize it was such recent history. Mm-hmm. Because you hear the song and you figure, oh, this is an 1800s vessel crossing the lake when, right, you know, boats were different, technology was different, weather still remains the same. But to have that impact in modern history is a little different looking at it at that lens versus some of the materials Tobias pulled here of like 1700s plus.
Right. I think if we look just strictly at Milwaukee, maybe one of the most impactful wrecks on the Great Lakes was the Lady Elgin. Not only because just about every one of the casualties was from Milwaukee, but because of the people who were on the boat, it really changed the political dynamic in Milwaukee. And that story can be found here in the library, not only in the Great Lakes collection, but if you look at the political archives and the History of Neighborhoods archives, that is all impacted by that one wreck.
Can you share a little more about that?
Well, what happened with the Lady Elgin is that a group of Irish politicians and firefighters were on their way to Chicago to see Stephen Douglas and to get some support for their position here in Milwaukee, and they were very politically prominent. Well, when that ship goes down and most of those people die, there is that vacuum of politics, and that allows the German community, which had strength, to become even stronger.
Obviously, there's so much here, but Tobias, is there anything that you look at in particular or have a favorite material or story?
I don't think there's any one particular record that I like more than all the others. I certainly like we've got a logbook over here, and so we have multiple logbooks, but just being able to hold something that was on the ship that speaks directly to not only where it was and what it was carrying, but the captain's name. This is from the Prince Wilhelm V. We've got the logbook here, but here's a photocopied version that we can touch a little easier. I just think these first sources are the most interesting to me, seeing what kind of information it held and what was important at the time.
The wind and the wires made a tattletale sound, and the wave broke over the railing.
Tobias Fudge is a special collections librarian at Milwaukee Public Library, and Anna Lardnoy is the author of Shipwrecks of the Great Lakes, among many other books. They both join me at Central Library for Lake Effects Books and Beyond series. A new season of Butler Talk is on the way, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. We'll take one more break, and then we'll help you plan a trip to Horicon Marsh. That's next on Lake Effect on WUWM. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Wisconsin has a lot of natural areas to visit, and they all vary widely in what you can see and do there. But one of the more unique natural areas that you can visit in the state is Horicon Marsh. It's a 33,000-acre wetland where you can hike, kayak, and, a big draw this time of year, catch the fall migrating birds. For this month's Wandering Wisconsin, Lake Effect's Becky Mortensen is joined by Liz Herman, the DNR's wildlife conservation educator at Horicon Marsh, and Amanda Weibel with Travel Wisconsin.
Liz, can you start by just describing Horicon Marsh and what people can see and do there?
Sure. So Horicon Marsh is this amazing wetland complex. It's a 33,000-acre wetland. It consists obviously of a lot of marsh, but it also has some woodlots and some prairies surrounding it in our uplands. And it's this expansive space. It covers about 50 square miles. There's really nothing else like it in the state. And because it's so large, it has this amazing wealth of wildlife, plants, and diversity, and just really a great opportunity for people to see a lot of species that are wetland specialists that they may not be able to see in other places across the state.
So what is it about the marsh that makes it such a great ecosystem for the plants, birds, and other wildlife that you can see there?
It's the size. It's 33,000 acres, which provides a lot of habitat for our wildlife. And for many people, they recognize Horicon as the largest freshwater cattail marsh in the contiguous United States. And so when you have something that large, you're going to have a lot of what animals need. You know, we talk about what animals need to survive, and it's food, it's water, and it's shelter. And the marsh is able to provide that and in a very vast amount. It also is essentially the headwaters of the Rock River. We have the East Branch of the Rock River and the West Branch flowing through. So you have this great aquatic ecosystem as well that helps produce all of the insects, whether they are hatching insects or they are aquatic insects that a lot of those animals need as a food source.
And the marsh is a big draw for birders. So what kinds of birds visit or live at Horicon Marsh?
Right. So if you haven't come to Horicon Marsh and seen a bird, then you definitely haven't been to Horicon Marsh. And we've seen and documented over 300 species of birds throughout the years at Horicon Marsh. And what I love about it is that each season you're going to see something different. And our busiest season for birders coming are the spring for our spring migration and up and coming now for our fall migration. But there's certainly birds that stay here all throughout the year. And we have everything from, again, our wetlands specialists like soras and Virginia rails and a multitude of different heron species. But we also get a lot of our migrants passing through because it is such a great stopover with food and water and shelter. So we get a lot of our songbirds, our warblers, our shorebirds that are moving through. So migration is a really interesting time. Everybody says, well, when does migration start? And in reality, migration is this long process that starts with different species of animals. So for us in the fall, we see migration starting even into July for some of our shorebirds coming through, and then into August for some of our warblers, and then September, October, November is a lot of our waterfowl and water birds that are coming through. So it's really this extended migration that whenever you come, you're going to see something, which is pretty exciting.
So it sounds like fall is a good time for birders to check out the marsh.
Yes, definitely. I think a lot of people that have come to the marsh or that we talk to and interact with here, you know, they have that memory of coming out to the marsh, you know, maybe back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, where the skies were just black with Canada geese, and that memory is ingrained in them. And although we may not see that many Canada geese at a time, which is actually a good thing, it's still an amazing stopover for migration. We're going to have hundreds of thousands of ducks moving through. What I actually love most about the fall is our crane migration. We get a huge number of sandhill cranes coming and utilizing the marsh as a roost location in big flocks and big groups. And one of my favorite things to do is just sit around the edge of the marsh somewhere about an hour before sunset and stake out a good location and just watch as the sandhill cranes come back in from the fields and roost in the marsh at night. It's a really amazing sight to be able to see.
I'm a big crane fan myself, so that sounds pretty amazing.
We do a crane watch or like a marsh watch just in case there's no cranes, but usually that's second Saturday in October. So we just have members of our local bird club come out and we set up a bunch of chairs and have chili and soup and enjoy whatever the evening brings for us.
Amazing. So you did mention those cattails. What can you tell me about the plants at the marsh?
Sure. So cattails are one of those interesting plants because it's what we're the most famous for. As I mentioned, we're known as the largest freshwater cattail marsh in the contiguous United States, but it's also the plant that we fight the most as property managers because they can get so dense and so thick that they can become what we call cattail deserts and actually not be great habitat for animals. So we have a lot of cattails. It is a food source for things like muskrat. They love to eat cattails. And we also have other pockets of diverse marsh species such as sedges and bulrush and a few sprigs of wild rice left over from back in the day. But cattails are something that we frequently work on from a management standpoint as far as trying to get rid of some of them, doing prescribed burns. Sometimes we'll do crushing of the cattails to try to lessen them. We'll do some chemical sprays in certain areas to open up those pockets and then allow more native vegetation to grow. We'll also do managed drawdowns where we're basically recreating a natural drought in different areas and allow all of the native seeds that are still in the soil bank a chance to get oxygen and sunlight and grow. And then once we get those plants established, it helps knock back some of the cattails. So yes, very famous for cattails, but actually would love to be a little less famous for them and have some more diversity growing in the marsh.
That's so interesting. I thought it was kind of this point of pride with the marsh. So that's pretty neat.
It is. It's because you're the biggest of something, right? So everybody's like, yeah, it must be great. But from a biologic standpoint, you want to have more than one species of plant. We want to have that diversity. And they're out there, but we'd love to see it in bigger numbers.
And you can do more than observe the plants and wildlife at the marsh. You can hunt, fish, and trap there. Is that right?
Yes, there's different rules and regulations depending on where you are in the marsh. So Horicon Marsh is interesting in that It's subdivided essentially into a state wildlife area, which is the southern one-third, which is owned and operated by Department of Natural Resources. And then the northern two-thirds is the Horicon National Wildlife Refuge, which is owned and operated by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And so because of that, we do have some different rules and regulations for hunting and trapping and fishing. There is no hunting of waterfowl species on the National Wildlife Refuge, but it is open and a part of the history of the state wildlife area. So we do recommend if people are interested in doing any hunting, fishing, trapping, they look at the local regulations. Obviously, they still have to follow all state and federal guidelines for hunting licenses and stamps and that type of thing. But there are certainly opportunities out there for everyone, depending on what your interests are.
All right, Amanda, I'm going to turn to you. There is a way to tour this marsh by boat. Can you share a bit about that?
Yes, you are going to want to check out Blue Heron Landing. They are a tour operator that's based out of the city of Horicon, and they have a variety of options to experience this natural wonder by boat. They run pontoon boat tours through the end of October, where an expert guide is going to lead you on a sightseeing tour of the marsh. So you're going to learn about the wildlife, the ecology, and the local history of the area. If you're looking for a little more solitude, you want to go out on your own, Blue Heron Landing also offers paddle rentals. So you can get a single or double kayak or a canoe and paddle your own way through the wetlands. And you're really just going to enjoy being surrounded by all that nature and wildlife.
And Horicon is also home to another outdoor recreation area, one of my favorites in Wisconsin, Dodge County Ledge Park. What can you share about that?
I'm really not surprised to hear that that's a favorite, Becky, because it really does show off one of Wisconsin's geological wonders. It lies along the Niagara Escarpment. So that's a unique geological feature that stretches for hundreds of miles along the remnants of an ancient sea. It starts in southeast Wisconsin and travels up through the state, through Door County, across Michigan's Upper Peninsula, and then into Canada. And the escarpment is defined by these high rocky cliffs. So at Dodge County Ledge Park, you are going to find a cliff that rises up 50 feet at points. And there's this great hiking trail along the cliff that lets you take it in from a ton of different perspectives. You definitely want to make sure that you go to the top of the cliff for amazing, amazing views. You're going to get this panoramic look at Horicon Marsh. And I mean, this is going to be stunning any time of year, but especially as the leaves are starting to change colors, it's a really good idea to visit. So I actually checked out Travel Wisconsin's fall color report, and the estimated peak color is forecasted for late October in Dodge County. So if you're planning a fall trip, you might want to keep an eye on that report as the leaves change. You can find it at travelwisconsin.com/fallcolorreport.
There are a lot of great places in Wisconsin where people can get outdoors, enjoy nature and wildlife. So some people might be asking themselves, why visit a marsh? So for each of you, why would you encourage people to visit the marsh and spend some time there?
That's a great question. And I think for me, the great thing about Horicon Marsh is it's different every time you go there. And so we always tell people, you know, you may have seen a very small portion of Horicon Marsh when you visited, but we can guarantee that every single time you come, you will see something different. You will experience something different. And people, whenever they come, they're like, man, I got to come back in the fall, or I've got to come back in the spring, and I've got to see this a different way. And so we really see that across the board, that Horicon Marsh is not just for a single season. It's really different and exciting every time. And so we hope that people recognize that and also recognize that it is a very large wetland, something else we don't really see anywhere else in the state. And so if you're really truly interested in those wetland species and seeing something, you know, they call it the little Everglades. So seeing something close to what you might see in southern Florida, in Wisconsin, it's pretty exciting.
We really are just so fortunate in Wisconsin to have such a variety of fantastic outdoor destinations. And each one tells a different story. Each one comes with unexpected experiences and new ways to make memories. And Horicon Marsh just truly is such a gem. It is a unique Wisconsin experience. So rich in wildlife, so rich in biodiversity, that it's absolutely a bucket list destination for any birder or any outdoor enthusiast. But I also love that it's very approachable for a new outdoorist. The Explorium is a really great starting point for families. It's fun and interactive and gives you an even better understanding of all the things that you're going to experience when you visit the marsh.
All right, Amanda and Liz, thank you both so much for joining me for Wandering Wisconsin.
Thanks for having us.
We appreciate it. Thanks.
Amanda Weibel is the Communications Officer for Travel Wisconsin. Liz Hersman is the DNR's Wildlife Conservation Educator at Horicon Marsh. They spoke with Lake Effect's Becky Mortensen for our series Wandering Wisconsin, where we help you plan a trip in our home state. You can find more trip recommendations at WUWM.com. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, Excret Nunez, and Jimmy Gutierrez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Robert Larry and Graham Thomas. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Chuck Kornbach, Taryn Powell, and Lena Tran from the WUWM news team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Villegas is our digital editor. Trapper Chef wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. Join us again on Monday at noon for a conversation with Ari Shapiro, who visited Milwaukee for NPR's Where Voters Are project. He'll share some more about that reporting, plus share some behind-the-scenes insight into being an All Things Considered host. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.